Okay, there'll be a couple of, there's a couple of different pieces of paper that you might want to look at. First of all, there's a draft letter, and the letter within it with an attached extensive table of comments. The letter highlights probably the, and from the staff's perspective or from the perspective of the SSC, four major issues. Then the comment table repeats those comments and touches on a lot of other issues. What I will do is cover the major four issues, any differences between staff and SSC comments, and also in the presentation, I'll cover all the SSC comments so that you will see all of those. And those will be in the original language from the SSC. Now, the materials are behind tab one, and there's also a discussion paper on the table for the audience that you can follow along. And I think we can probably get started with that. But I need to, yeah, just put that. You can go to the next one, Karen. Okay. And I'm going to ask you to go two slides down, actually. The first issue was that the staff, first major issue that the staff and the SSC commented on was the inclusion of an ACT, or annual catch target. You can flip back up to the next slide. Just leave that. And the National Standard Guidelines conceptualize the use of ABC, ACL, and annual catch target in the following manner. They specify that ABC, acceptable biological catch, should be less than or equal to the overfishing level, and that the annual catch limit set by the council should be less than or equal to the accepted biological catch. Furthermore, so that the annual catch limit is not exceeded, the National Standard Guidelines added an annual catch target. And the difference between the annual catch target and the annual catch limit would be to account for management uncertainty. For example, in a effort control program, if it's purely an effort control program, the effort control specifications may lead to exceeding the annual catch limits. Or if it's a hard quota fishery, it's conceivable that a fishery is closed, but either bycatch is not properly accounted for, or the landings were still coming in from the species, or there was incidental catch after the quota was reached. So this is the way it was approached in the guidelines. You can go to the previous one. Yeah. This was a comment from our SSC and the staff. They felt that an annual catch target really wasn't necessary. And their comment, I'm going to read these in full. This is from the SSC, was, it is appropriate to list the annual catch target as a suggested component of a fishery management plan rather than require it as a legally mandated component of an FMP. Using an act as proposed in the guidelines as a way of trying to separately account for management uncertainty, although the act may clearly distinguish management uncertainty from other sources of uncertainty, adding a target does not fundamentally improve the process. The SSC suggested that if you set if the ACL is properly set, the council or an FMP should not need an annual catch target. They did not want to preclude other councils, or if councils chose to use an annual catch target, from doing so. So that's why they suggested that it be a still be an option. Continuing, they commented that it is more important to correctly adjust the ACL based on actual performance data, looking at how the ACLs performed retrospectively, than to create a separate target or act control rule based on some type of theoretical approach before you've seen how an FMP has had a chance to perform. So that's the. Are there any questions about that particular comment? Okay, let's go two down. Go one more. Another provision in the guidelines is the guidelines include an option to define overfishing in terms of catch rather than as a rate of fishing mortality. I'm just going to read through the SSC comment. By the way, this comment does not preclude councils from using targets to manage fisheries and target catches. There's nothing in this comment that says you shouldn't manage a fishery with a quota. It just says after the fact, when you go to see what happened in terms of your assessment information, look at overfishing in terms of a fishing mortality rate or a fishing mortality proxy, such as an exploitation rate. And basically, so the SSC's comment was redefining overfishing in terms of catch also doesn't appear to be consistent with the MSA. There could be cases where catch is later found to be greater than FMSY, or the catch associated with FMSY, but where the catch would not exceed the overfishing level or the ACL based on the best available science. This situation could occur when there's a strong retrospective pattern in stock assessments, as has been the case for some of the more important stocks in the Northeast. Also, defining overfishing in terms of fishing mortality or a proxy exploitation rate wherever possible does not prevent managers from using ACLs and target catches for the ongoing management of a fishery. Actually, this is a comment that this is actually the paragraph that's in the letters, not precisely the SSC wording. And both the staff and the SSC had that comment. And again, if there are some questions about this issue, I can answer them now. Okay, the next issue is the guidelines say, whenever possible, FMPs should include in-season monitoring and management measures to prevent catch from exceeding ACLs. The SSC's comment about this provision is that the purpose of accountability measures should be to adjust ACLs to prevent overfishing. Although ACLs should not be exceeded on a regular basis, adjustment of ACLs through accountability measures, or AMs, will need to be based on performance data. Therefore, it is reasonable to implement accountability measures after reviewing annual data rather than making in-season adjustments. Now, in the letter, we explained that there might be a little bit of a semantical difference. Again, doesn't preclude the council from putting in-season measures to prevent ACLs being exceeded. But the staff and the SSC were suggesting that can be confusing measures that are really an integral part of the plan with accountability measures that are to deal with ACL overages. The staff comment was, it's not clear here whether should means must or may. Because this is such an important issue, further clarification is needed. So the staff is just suggesting that the guidelines make sure that they tell the councils whether this is how important the should is. Is it a must or a may? Any comments or questions about this particular comment? Okay, might as well go to the next one.
Dave.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One question I had was, it seems to me that in-season adjustments are incompatible with any rights-based management or limited access privilege programs. Is that anything that was considered?
If you read the staff comment, there is the last part of it, there is an issue that actually suggests that if we make an in-season adjustment, you don't have rights-based management, you can have problems with a derby fishery. For example, if you were working on a pure days at sea program and you closed it early, the next year people would probably race to fish, or if they anticipated you were going to close an effort control fishery early. But we didn't get into that issue directly, Dave. Next issue. The other major issue that was identified were the requirements for additional information in FMPs. The National Standard Guidelines say that in their FMPs, council should describe general data collection methods as well as any specific data collection methods used for all stocks, stock complexes, and goes on to describe some other things. Secondly, describe data collection and estimation methods used to quantify total catch mortality in each fishery, including information on the management tools used, such as logbooks, vessel monitoring systems, observer programs, landings reports, fish tickets, processor reports, dealer reports, recreational angler surveys, or other methods. The frequency with which data are collected and updated, and the scope of the sampling coverage of the fishery, and the methods used to compile data from various catch data collection methods. So I'll go to the next. The staff comment on this is standardized bycatch reporting methodology requirement should already fulfill this requirement. This is a huge burden. Notice that it says the FMP must describe not only data collection, but the estimation methods used to quantify total catch mortality in the fishery. And one of the questions is, does this mean councils must describe assessment methods in their FMPs? And we feel a lot of this is well documented in the SAW process or in the data collection programs by the fishery service. And we don't want to have to repeat these descriptions in the FMP documents, which we feel are already long enough. So that's why we felt this was an important issue. Any comments on that? Okay, let's go to
Dave.
Yeah, basically, I agree with you, Chris. There seems to be a general push now to micromanage everything in terms of data collection, and to what end?
Well,
that's what I don't understand, is what is everybody trying to get with all this data other than to have hundreds of people sitting around counting pieces of paper? I don't see that it's getting us better information. It may be getting us more information, but it's getting us the same information over and over again. Yeah. So I do think we really need to get somebody to answer the question why.
Yeah, we're not commenting on that issue, whether we've got whether we're collecting more data than is useful so much, but we just don't want to include that description of the data program in the FMP, and we're not sure what the reason is for including it. So, next slide. Let's see, where are we? Fishing level recommendation, okay. Another recommendation in the National Standard Guidelines was that each Regional Fishery Management Council shall develop ACLs for each of its managed fisheries that may not exceed the fishing level recommendations of its SSC or peer review process. And the SSC feels that the final recommendation for ABC should come from the SSC and not the peer review process. The peer review process or council plan development teams could provide alternatives and appropriate information about uncertainty, stock vulnerability, alternative candidates for ABCs, et cetera, for the SSC to consider. In relation to existing stock assessment peer review processes, The SSC's role should be interpretive and not to provide additional peer review to the work that has already been peer reviewed. Any comments on that particular issue?
Jim Otto.
I have a little concern with the SSC's comments. If I read it right, what they're trying to say is that going forward, they don't really have to follow the peer review recommendations and that they can decide to override something that's been peer reviewed. And I have a problem with that if I'm interpreting that right.
Well, I think one of the issues here is that our SAW process doesn't necessarily make fishing level recommendations. And as you'll see coming out of the SAW, it may go up through a certain year and may not be able, and we usually rely on the PDT to, and the committee to then bridge the gap by putting in the right fishing mortality assumptions for the current year, let's say, that's not covered by the SAW. So usually out of our SAW, we're not getting those recommendations. And, you know, we feel that we need some more work done to bridge the gap, and then the SSC would look at it from that point of view. So this comment basically said, addresses the fact, do you want the SAW to make the fishing level recommendations? And right now our SAW isn't a term of reference for it, but that's the issue this addresses. Okay, let's go to the next one. These slides are out of the presentation you've already seen in June, or I think it was June, maybe April, on the National Standard Guidelines. Actually, it was June. And the guidelines have some definition for stocks in the fishery, target stocks, non-target stocks, and non-target stocks that are not retained and could likely be subject to overfishing or overfished. Go to the next one. And ecosystem component species, and which is a type of non-target species. And let's go to the next one. The staff had a number of concerns about the classification of stocks in the fishery and what that might imply for FMPs. When the SSC looked at this issue, they also had a comments on it, but a slightly different perspective. They thought that this type of classification is needed. At some level, they noted it would be useful to know all the stocks and species which are encountered by the gears in a given fishery. I think we do a pretty good job of that in our FMPs, but they're suggesting this should be required. Stocks in a particular fishery should have a similar geographic distribution or be caught together in a fishery rather than simply share a similar biological classification. That's more of maybe a technical comment. Stocks should be not grouped unless they have similar characteristics and vulnerabilities. The classifications should be simpler. An ecosystem's component species and a non-target species that is not retained seem to be the same. This distinction needs clarification. Furthermore, is it a useful distinction? There may be ecosystem components that are important to consider. The council should consider whether they should be included in an FMP. And finally, the council might not benefit from the staff's suggestion that more specific guidance is needed on some of these classifications because it could reduce the council's flexibility to determine what it might want to include as an ecosystems component. The staff comments, and there were a couple of staff comments. You can go to the next one. That suggested that some clarification was needed on certain points, and those were that the guidelines say that that ecosystems component species should be evaluated to determine if they are vulnerable to the fishery, but they include no criteria for making this provision operational. So this comment's basically suggesting that the guidelines should include some criteria. Does vulnerable mean that a species is frequently, sometimes, or infrequently caught in the gear, or does it mean that the fishery has some or a lot or a little impact on the species in question? Second issue was, how much incidental catch is needed for a non-target stock to be identified? So the staff was looking for further clarification. The SSC was suggesting, since including these things is optional, that the council may want the flexibility and not want the guidelines to kind of lock you into a certain box. Any comments or questions on these? Are you inclined to go with the, at some point, one thing you might comment on later on is whether you're inclined to go with the staff or the SSC comment on this issue. And I don't know whether you want to do that now or when we're through going through this, John.
I'd prefer, as we're going through the letter, to make the decisions. Does anyone have a strong preference one way or the other? Chris, can you restate the decision that you're asking the council to make?
Okay. The SSC suggests that the council may not benefit from the staff suggestion that more specific guidance is needed on defining when an ecosystem's components, more specific guidance is needed on vulnerability criteria that would define an ecosystem's component species, or how much incidental catch is needed for a non-target stock to be identified as a non-target stock. And if you think the council needs more flexibility, you should go with the SSC comment.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, first of all, it's hard to follow this presentation relative to the many-paged, very well-done description of the National Standard Number 1 guidelines and the staff plus the SSC recommendations, which are quite lengthy, detailed, and extremely well done. So I'd appreciate a bit more instruction as to where we are within that,
okay,
within that table. It'll help me better reference my own notes as to what I would like to address. I think that Chris is saying that the SSC's recommendation would provide more flexibility to the council, and the staff's recommendation would provide less flexibility to the council. That raises an issue. Why is the staff recommending an interpretation or comments that would actually take away flexibility for the council?
Well, I think the staff, at the time they looked at it, if they were going to deal with these issues of vulnerability and how you determine them or how you define a non-target stock, didn't know how to do that. And operationally, the staff and the PDTs were going to have to figure out how to do that. The SSC, if you put two bodies to look at a different question, they may look at it from a different perspective. And they're advising you that since it's optional, you may want the additional flexibility. Just keep it. Don't ask for. Be afraid of what you ask for. Okay. I don't know how else to boil it down more than that, David. And I can find the. I'll try and locate the. Well, even in the table, you're not going to get. You'd have to go to the guidelines, I think, to look through the definition, and that's just a problem to deal with that level of detail at this meeting.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would be supportive of more flexibility from the standpoint of if we had a standard guideline on this, what applies to one fisheries management plan may not be appropriate for other fisheries management plans, and I think it would be give us a lot more. I think we'd do a better job if we could tailor it to the specific ecosystems requirements of each fisheries management plan.
Dave Gaith.
Yeah, I think I would kind of, in a way, combine the two. I think the question we really want to ask here is for simplification of this entire process. I mean, let's use a real example. How important is the effect on longhorn sculpins of ground fishing? That's what we're asking here. That's an example. And the question is, okay, probably not very important, and furthermore, we probably don't care very much. We want as much flexibility as possible, but we also want simplification, you know, some kind of guideline as to when, if something becomes important, if the effect of ground fishing on the longhorn sculpin population starts to become significant, or we suspect it is, how should we account for it? What should we do about it? In the absence of that, I don't think we should do anything. I mean, I think we should basically, you know, try and ignore this part of it entirely, unless somebody comes up and says, you know, I think you're having a negative effect on longhorn sculpins, and I think you ought to do something about it. And then I'd like some guidance as to what it is exactly they'd like me to do about it.
Yeah.
That would be how I try to write this up to make them, you know, look at it from the perspective of a real time situation.
Dr. Pierce.
All right, now I'm on the right page. This particular difference of opinion between the SSC and the staff is described on page 2 and page 3 of the detailed draft comments. And when I went through these draft comments, I was impressed with the council staff's evaluation of this part of the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, that is the ecosystem component to EC species. The staff perspective, I think, is right on target. Some very meaningful questions are asked of those who crafted these National Standard Number 1 guidelines. And as a consequence of that, I would prefer to go with the staff's position and not to go with the SSC's position, since they are different positions and the staff's position seems to be the stronger one.
Just one comment. There are a lot of questions that would still be included, and I think all those staff issues could be included. It's just the specific comments within of the staffs that ask about clarification on these two issues. Those would be the only comments that would be inconsistent with the SSC comments, just what you see on the board and not what else is in the staff comments. So, I mean, it's not like dueling comments between the staff and the SSC. It's just on this particular issue.
Okay, well, again, this is the first time I've seen this particular letter. It was received this morning, so I'm trying to reconcile what's in the letter versus what I spent a lot of time going through. And I think you're saying that, well, I'm not sure what you're saying now, it's not a question of saying the SSC's position in blue text is the position we should support or the other position we should support. That is the staff's, which is detailed in black. I thought that this particular language was basically a summary of what's in that text. Because if it is a summary of what's in that text, if this staff position captures the flavor of that text on page 2 and 3, then I would support it, as opposed to what the SSC has offered.
Yeah. What I'm saying, David, is I think there's a lot of valid issues in the staff comments asking questions, and what I was asked to do was highlight the differences, and the differences are only in these two bulleted items. I think that's what the SSC was getting at. The council could submit the SSC comments, also all the staff comments that are in this table, delete these two bullets if you thought that somehow this was going to limit your flexibility, and have all the other valid questions about what's an ecosystem component species and that there's problems, and ask for clarification on some other issues. What we were doing in the letter was just try to put some emphasis on, let's say, four big issues and submit everything that's in the table in addition to the letter. and rely on the detailed wording in the table for people who are actually working with the guidelines, trying to figure out what we're talking about.
Dave, arguably most of the issues that have been raised by the SSC and the staff could become big issues in the right context. The letter was, I asked Chris to write this letter to highlight the four big, meaty issues contained within the proposed rule. But the concept was to attach that chart that you see in your binder with the staff comments and the SSC comments. And I think what Chris is doing is, beyond the letter, identifying a couple of other places within the chart, or the comparison chart, where the council may want to delete one comment or another and not forward it on.
And to give you some perspective, this is probably about one of the most minor issues in a way we have. This is pretty much of a nuance. All right, well, let's proceed to the next slide. And some of these issues, also what I'm doing here is going through all the SSC comments, because you're not receiving an SSC report on this, but their comments are fairly brief, so we'll cover them all. In terms of annual catch limits, the SSC supports the idea that ACL should serve as a basis for invoking accountability measures. The purpose of ACLs is to prevent overfishing, and therefore they must be adjusted if not correctly set. Accountability measures are the mechanism for adjusting ACLs and the buffer between ACLs and ABC to account for uncertainties in the assessment, environmental factors, and in the ability of management to actually control fishing mortality. If there is more uncertainty, the buffer should be larger, and if scientific information and management controls are more precise, the ACL can be set closer to the ABC. Also, the size of the buffer should be contingent on the level of overages, if applicable. Now, I've just underlined the last sentence that's of a little interest. I'm not asking for a different comment on this. Because there will always be some uncertainty in these factors, the ACL will be less than the ABC. So the SSC is actually pointing out that if you're really looking for uncertainty, dealing with uncertainty by setting your annual catch limits, you're probably going to be less than the ABC. You'll find that's a little different than what the presentation we got on the National Standard Guidelines. Another issue is the MSY definition. MSY is, in the National Standard Guidelines, they include, I'm just going to try and move this a little quicker, they've added the consideration that I'm going to have to read it, sorry. MSY is the longest long-term average catcher yield that can be taken from a stock or stock complex under prevailing ecological, environmental conditions, and fishery technological characteristics such as gear selectivity and the distribution of catch among fleets. Our SSC and staff thought that technological considerations should not be included in the estimate of MSY. MSY should not be constrained by current selectivity patterns of fishing gear or fishing practices. Constraining MSY by a particular set of fishery technological characteristics, which result in a suboptimal selectivity pattern, such as the retention of immature fish, could result in potentially large losses in yield. And the scallop fishery was an example. Both the staff and the SSC felt that an example of this was if you locked the definition of MSY into the technological characteristics of the scallop fishery that we had in, the early 90s, we would have an inappropriate definition of MSY.
Dr. Pierce and then Sally McGee.
Yeah, I just wanted to back up a little bit to the previous slide, Chris, on the annual catch limits.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. That is the SSC. Is that text the same text that's on page 8, the blue text?
I think
so. Or is that a blend?
It should be.
Okay, well, assuming it is the same text on page 8, the text that's in blue, my question is, the staff after hearing the SSC position, I assume, agrees with the SSC position? There's no disagreement on this issue?
We didn't come back to this issue on the staff and try and resolve any differences. But the staff is basically in agreement that AMs are to adjust ACLs and deal with management uncertainty. There's no need to therefore have an annual catch target if you properly specify the ACLs and use the AMs. In terms of the last sentence, that's a comment. I'm not sure that that's that's not something the staff really looked at.
I think
the last sentence is valuable because it points to a potential problem in the way the guidelines were presented by the service. They said, well, ABC could equal your ACL. You'll find in the presentation there's an entirely different view from SSC for specific stock complex down in the South Atlantic that was just put in to give you a flavor of how difficult it is for different people who were commenting on these guidelines.
Sally McGee.
Was there any discussion at the SSC about ACLs and AMs applying to subcomponents or different sectors of a fishery? I know there was some discussion amongst staff about that, but did the SSC take that up?
The SSC had no problems with having ACLs applied to subcomponents, and I think the guidelines say that that's an option. There was a staff comment that asked for clarification whether you could mix, have ACLs apply to some subcomponents but not to others to give the council flexibility. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. But that's more of a question in the staff comments.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how you plan to proceed with this letter, but I would say that how we deal with catch limits in different subcomponents of a fishery or bycatch in related fisheries is something that we struggle with a lot and that this council should be commenting on. I have a motion to that effect to add a short addition to the letter, but I would highlight that just because it's something we struggle with all the time. In the herring fishery as it relates to groundfish, in the scallop fishery as it relates to groundfish, we have to get a handle on this and we're constantly struggling with it, so I think it's worth our highlighting that and calling that out in the letter.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm growing a bit uncomfortable with this, what I think is a developing position that these accountability measures are basically an after-the-fact type way to address annual catch limit exceedances. I'm okay with the concept that we don't need ACTs because we can build enough uncertainty buffer into the ACL when properly specified. But thought to me that we wouldn't have some kind of mid-course correction capability, an in-season accountability measure to prevent that ACL from being exceeded and only address it after the fact by some other action. I'm getting uncomfortable with that. If that's what I'm reading into the text of the letter and the positions that are being laid out here. mean, I think if you examine the history of groundfish management and the history of the GARM series now, it's clear that the management system on groundfish is too loose with regards to preventing overfishing and attainment of overfish status. And I would hate to see this council take a position that we can't make in-course corrections when we think we need to, because we're coming up on an ACL, regardless of whether it's an output control, you know, hard tax system, or whether it's days at sea effort limitation type system. So if that's where we're going, I'm getting uncomfortable with that. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Before Chris, before you speak, Sally, I'm going to ask you to hold your motion to amend the letter, and anyone else that has motions to amend the letter. We have time set aside in the agenda if we need it after lunch, and I think that's the period of time. Unless Chris can get through the rest of the points here, that'll be the time that we go after the letter, the language of the letter. Chris.
Yeah. I just wanted to respond to Mark's concern. There's nothing, I think, in the drift of the comments that suggest that the council shouldn't design a management plan so that ACL should not be exceeded during the normal during the fishing year. And though any preventative measures that you think are useful should be in the plan. The guidelines also, there is a suggestion in the guidelines that suggests that annual catch limits should not be exceeded more frequently than perhaps one in every 4 years. And I think what the SSC is saying, that ACLs, they've supported the use of ACLs, and that as a on a regular basis, the ACL should not be exceeded. But they just felt that that's what that was the purpose of putting in accountability measures. That doesn't prevent the council from, if, for example, using a projected closure based on attack, or putting in trigger mechanisms, or using in-season accountability measures. They just said that there shouldn't be an emphasis, that should be an option to use accountability measures later. I don't know. I don't know if that helps. Do we want to go?
Anything further? Chris?
Let's go to the next slide. Let's go one beyond that. Maximum rebuilding period. The National Standard Guidelines suggested a maximum rebuilding period that's basically based on the average age of a mature female. And there are some situations in which that might result in, might not be appropriate. The SSC recommended going back to a definition that was in a publication by Restrepo. Not being a biologist, if you have some specific questions about that, I would ask Andy Applegate to answer those, but I just wanted to highlight all the SSC comments. And they thought that it was technically more correct to go with the suggestion they've provided, and that's in the second to the last comment in the table. And basically it's what's on the board, but not detailed. So that's on. That would be on page 13. Okay, unless you want to get into the details of the SSC comment, you know, my suggestion is you adopt that comment. The staff had some of the same concerns, and the SSC had a more technical, maybe more technically correct or clearer way of looking at this, or a better suggestion. Let's go to the next slide.
Mark Gibson.
What, I guess a question I have, I don't know who can answer it, but which one provides for longer or shorter time period, rebuilding time periods? Just at first look, it looks to me as though the initial definition would provide for a shorter rebuilding time period because you're talking about exploited populations and not taking account of the concept of maximum possible age in the females. But I'd like to hear from someone who's an expert in either of them. This, you know, the issue is how much time, extra time do you have? And these definitions could provide for differential time rebuilding timeline.
So the proposed guidelines use a definition of generation time that's consistent with a species with a low natural mortality rate pre-spawning, and so provides a shorter period for rebuilding, potential rebuilding in stocks that can't be rebuilt within 10 years. The SSC recommendation is basically consistent, although a little more technical than the staff explanation, and provides for a longer rebuilding period, which properly takes into account changes in fecundity and higher fishing mortality rate or natural mortality rates that you find in marine populations. So provide a longer rebuilding period for the SSC recommendation.
Anything further on this point? Chris, anything else?
Yeah, there's one more issue. And this is an exception to requirements to prevent overfishing. The guidelines provide an exception to ending overfishing, and basically, they could apply under certain limited circumstances. Harvesting one stock at its optimum level may result in overfishing of another stock when the two stocks tend to be caught together. The councils may decide to allow this type of overfishing if all the following conditions are satisfied. One, the action will result in long-term net benefits to the nation. Two, mitigating measures have been considered, and it has been demonstrated that a similar level of long-term net benefits cannot be achieved by modifying fleet behavior, gear selection, configuration, or other technical characteristics in a manner such that no overfishing would occur. And three, the resulting rate of fishing mortality will not cause any stock or stock complex to fall below its minimum spawning stock threshold more than 50% of the time in the long term, although it's recognized that persistent overfishing is expected to cause the affected stock to fall below the BMSY for more than 50% of the time in the long term. Next slide, Karen. And the staff comment was, the staff comment was basically they let the chips fall where they are. Although this might provide some flexibility, it was our view that there does not appear to be a statutory basis for this provision anywhere in the MSA. Nowhere does it say that overfishing can be allowed except in accordance with an international agreement. And then we had some problems with the criteria. To meet these criteria would be very difficult. And as proposed, the regulation would allow managers to allow overfishing to continue for a period of time on a stock that is not overfished, even if the stock declines in size. I don't want to go into the details. So that was a staff view, just because they were trying to be consistent what was in and what was not in the Magnuson Act. Next slide, Karen. The SSC acknowledged that there doesn't appear to be a basis in the Act for this provision. It said, however, the provision is entirely reasonable, in some cases offers the flexibility to practically implement other provisions of the Act, even though it may be very difficult to meet the criteria. Their point of view was, well, maybe this isn't such a bad idea to allow the council this flexibility. So that's the last comment that I wanted to highlight, some differences between the staff and the SSC.
Dr. Pierce, then Sally McGee.
Yeah, this one, exceptions to requirements to prevent overfishing, is one of my favorites because it's the mixed stock exception that has existed in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines for an awful long time, going back to 1998, 1998 language that I really love. It's never been used, but still, it's in there, and I favor that language. At the last council meeting, we had a presentation regarding, well, maybe it wasn't the last, but recently we had a presentation, I think it was from Mark Milliken, where I asked the question, is the mixed stock exception still in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines? And he said, yes, but the bar has been raised, and he had a smile on his face. And he's correct. He raised the bar, and the staff did recognize that. So here's where I have my quandary, in that I like the fact that the National Standard Number 1 guidelines still have the mixed stock exception, although it's not called that. The language has been massaged a little bit, so it's somewhat changed. It's not as obvious, but it is the exception. So I like the fact that the service has continued that exception, but I acknowledge that the staff has hit the nail on the head. The exception is now so difficult to meet, that is, the criteria is so difficult to meet, impossible to meet, the staff says, why bother to have it in there? So, again, I'm torn. The SSC, appropriately enough, recognizes that this provision, a mixed stock exception, is entirely reasonable and in some cases offers the flexibility needed to practically implement other provisions of the Act. In other words, to enable us to take the OY for species that are especially in a healthy condition. I'll have a motion to make a little while later, but I just wanted to highlight the fact that NIMS, you're right on target. Then again, you're not on target. Staff, you hit the nail on the head, yet you don't, because your first bullet, I disagree with the first bullet about there's no statutory basis for this provision. And then the SSC, again, I think they're going in the right direction. So with that said, that'll serve as a prelude to a motion that I'll make in a little while, but I'll let Sally go forth.
Sally?
Well, I just wanted to highlight that both the SSC and the staff agree that there's no provision in the law to support this. And I think that the comments that we submit should say just that and leave it at that, rather than opening yet another gray area where this council has in the past gotten into trouble and may well again. So I would suggest that in this case, contrary to the previous comment, that we should just be saying there does not appear to be a basis in the Act for this provision.
Anyone else on this point? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I would favor saying something to the effect of either take it out altogether or make it practical to use. The way it is right now, it's pretty much lip service to be useless. I think we've got to, you know, with this type of operation, you've got to send a direct message to people. I mean, the language here is incredibly complicated, and I think we ought to just sound like either take it out altogether or put something in there that you can actually use, because the way this is, it's practically impossible to use it. So why have it?
Chris, is that it? You have more?
This is the last issue that I wanted to highlight. I know that everybody's read the table thoroughly, so the other comments that are in the table would be included in the letter as written.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So we have a letter in the binder. I know of at least one, if not two, motions to amend that letter. And we also have the tables that we just reviewed. The plan is to submit a letter from the council and to have tables accompany the letter. So now is the time. Dr. Pierce.
I'm not going to make the motion you think I'm going to make, Mr. Chairman, but there's something else that I think needs to be included in this letter, and it's extremely important. And I say that from the perspective of a TMGC member. And I reference a letter that is in our binder. Actually, it was provided at the beginning of this meeting. I think it's from Pat Kirkle, relative to the international agreements and the fact that an understanding is not an international agreement. Therefore, we cannot, in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, exempt stocks that are managed through an understanding from ACLs and AMs. As proposed, those stocks that have an international agreement can be exempted. That's being proposed. And that is a very good suggestion from the National Marine Fisheries Service. In particular, I refer you to page 32531 in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines. And that would be under the section 9, statutory exceptions to requirements for ACLs and AMs and flexibility in application of National Standard Number 1 guidelines, where the National Marine Fisheries Service hits it right on the head. I mean, this is right on point. And that would be the middle column on that page at the very end, where they note that given Congress's recognition of the increasing problem of international overfishing and the complexities of international negotiation, NIMS believes that the ACL exception should apply to fisheries that are subject to management under international agreements in which the U.S. participates. And here's the statement. Applying ACLs or AMs only to the U.S. portion of the catch would not affect rebuilding or end overfishing, would potentially disadvantage U.S. fishermen with respect to foreign fishermen, and could weaken U.S. negotiating positions at international fora in which it participates. Quite true. And I think that that language, that thought, that rationale is very pertinent and applicable to our dealings with the Canadians on Georges Bank stocks, our so-called resource sharing understanding. I realize that the Magnuson Act references specifically the international agreements and doesn't bring us to the sharing agreements. However, it seems to me that the way in which the National Marine Fisheries Service has offered up this guidance, they are giving us an opportunity to, through that guidance, to acknowledge the fact that we do have our own unique situation, that is the transboundary resource sharing understanding. I would like to apply the same language in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines relative to international agreements to the resource understanding. So I would make a motion that international agreements and transboundary resource sharing understandings be treated the same way in National Standard Number 1 guidance. That is, they be exempt from ACL and AM requirements.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mary Beth Tooley. Dave, any further discussion or explanation?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking down the road on this one. I'm not just focusing on groundfish. I'm thinking about sea herring. I know that the service is attempting to put together a resource sharing agreement on sea herring, notably Area 1A herring. And I can envision a very significant dilemma for all of us if we don't have this sort of flexibility to deal with the Canadians in our negotiations relative to an understanding that could be developed for sea herring and other species too. For example, last year, the Canadians caught approximately 30,000 metric tons of Area 1A fish in the New Brunswick weir fishery. Well, the overall quota for Area 1A is 45,000. that has implications down the road for us. So clearly, the U.S., this council, will continue to be restrictive and continue to do what it needs to do relative to the Magnuson Act. But at the same time, when we enter into negotiations, I don't like sitting down at the table with our Canadian counterparts knowing that I'm in a very weakened position, because they know what we have to do through our law, and they don't have to do the same thing. When we have our TMGC meeting coming up very shortly, we will be disadvantaged. And I'd like to start now with this particular motion, with this suggestion to the service. I would like to start down the road of our, again, being consistent with that very sensible language that's in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines that pertains to agreements, international agreements, but apply that to understandings as well. It's not in the Magnuson Act, but there's a lot in these National Standard Number 1 guidelines that's not in the Magnuson Act. So let's give ourselves this flexibility to be good negotiators that will be arguing and negotiating from a position of increased strength as opposed to just weakness.
Anything further from the council? If I just make a quick comment on this motion, it seems to me the primary disadvantage that the United States may have in the TMGC meetings would be related to the rebuilding timeline, and that's the generator of the situation that we find ourselves at a disadvantage. And you're right, Dave, this upcoming TMGC meeting is going to be difficult, and we're going to get into that later today. But at the same time, I can't help but wonder what are all the other implications for domestic fishermen, the U.S. fishermen, if something like this were to pass. How far does it reach? We're not even sure that our counterpart right now would want to have a formalized agreement. I'll just offer up those comments. Paul Howard.
If the council members would look at 10G in your binder, it was the letter that we sent off to Pat Kirkle, and basically another way, I think, of putting David's motion is to say that the sections of the Magnuson Act that deal with rebuilding overfished fisheries, 10-104-297 and 109-479, those exceptions would apply to, those two exceptions about rebuilding would apply to international transboundary resource sharing agreements, if that's the intent of that motion, that'd be a way of doing that.
I'm sorry, Paul, what letter are you referencing? 10K?
Tab 3, 10G.
Tab 3, 10G.
That's the part of the act that deals with international agreements, and if we could get an international agreement to be similar to our TMGC, then those two sections would be pretty much an exception.
Give Dave and others a chance to reference that letter. Anything further from the council on the motion on the board? Sally McGee.
Yeah, I understand the desire to go to a negotiating table with a fair or level playing field, but at the same time, if the U.S. is taking actions to raise the standards by which our fisheries are managed, why should we be setting that aside when we go to an international table just to make sure we get a bigger piece of the pie? And maybe that is reason enough for some people to say we should just cast aside our standards when we're involved in an international agreement. But I think that's not a good enough reason, so I'm going to oppose this motion.
Mark Gibson.
So we've asked a question in this August 22nd letter. We don't have a response back yet. So why are we doing this now? That's my question.
There, I think there is a response to that letter.
Yeah, there is a response.
Yeah.
Tab 310K. The issue that we're dealing with right now is a difference in the domestic fishery law requiring a lower F rate than perhaps our counterparts that we're negotiating with are inclined to take. That's the difference, and that happens when we're in our rebuilding plan, when we have a stock that's below half of where it's supposed to be, and we initiate a rebuilding plan, and the F rates on our side need to be lower than perhaps the Canadians would be inclined to accept. But we still, if you look at the TMGC process right now, you could argue we have ACLs and AMs built into the process. We set rates, and we establish quotas based on those rates, and we have a mechanism annually to deduct overages. So I'm not David, that's why I said it's really the 10-year rebuilding requirement that sets up the disparity between the two sides when they sit down. It's not necessarily the ACLAM component of the law. David.
All right. I appreciate that fact. Without referencing the letter that Pat sent to us in reply, without having it in front of me, it's somewhere here. Was the response along the lines of you must? In other words, the recommendation suggestion made by Paul in the letter to Pat, is that a recommendation that was favorably received? I think not. So if it's not favorably received because of the way the Magnuson Act is worded, then to get around that, I think in this most simplistic way, this motion could apply. Because it just takes that section of the National Standard Number 1 guidelines as proposed, statutory exemptions to requirements for ACLs and AMs, and applies the same excellent logic to the resource sharing understandings that we have with Canada. So I would like to leave it as is. It all comes down to, I suspect, whether the National Marine Fisheries Service will just want to use the National Standard Guidelines as a mean to apply this sound rationale to our workings with the Canadians.
Jim Adler.
Yes, having been on the TMGC for going on 6 years, I support this motion. I think that if we don't have something like this, then the existing agreement stands a very good chance of falling apart, and that will cause the U.S. fishermen and U.S. industry to suffer, and the chance of getting any meaningful agreements on other species, which to me looks like we're going to have to start working towards, not just herring, mackerel, probably pollock, probably hake, that the agreements just won't mean anything, because we will be forced to take the Canadian catch off the top, which we had to do prior to having any kind of agreement. So I think this type of motion is needed, and I support it. Thank you.
Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Twelve opposed. Three abstentions, one. Motion carries 12-3 with one abstention. Sally, you had a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a motion that Karen has, and it's to add one kind of simple overarching sentence with two simple messages in it, rather than kind of going down in the weeds where we've been for the last hour. And that is to move that the council letter on the proposed rule for National Standard 1 include the following sentence. National Standard 1 guidelines should require managers to develop ACLs and AMs for all components of a fishery and ensure that annual catch limits account for dead discards and other fishing-related mortality. And I would just I would add one addition to that, Karen, if you could, after all components of the fishery, if you could add when practicable. And if I get a second, then I'd like to offer my rationale.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mark Gibson. Sally?
As I mentioned before, I think that we need to be expressing to National Marine Fisheries Service some of the issues that this council deals with all the time, and that is the interactions between between fisheries as well as interactions within fisheries, and making sure that we're actually accounting for all catch, whether it's commercial or recreational, whether it's different gear types, whether it's a directed fishery or bycatch. We have a precedent set in the herring fishery where we have a set aside of haddock, yellowtail, and the scallop fishery. I think we need to, as we are bumping up the bar according to the new Magnuson requirements, to make sure that we are actually accounting for all of those components. The second part of the sentence relating to making sure that we're actually accounting for all sources of mortality is just really simple, that the council should express that we need to include all sources of mortality, including dead discards and other fishing-related mortality. I think those are important messages for this council to be expressing as you know, it's part of the discussions that we've had, not only with respect to groundfish, but other fisheries, to make sure that we're getting the numbers right. The better we get the numbers, the closer we're going to be able to fish at optimum yield. Thank you.
Anything further from the council? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is a nice idea in concept, but it has huge, huge practical implications. It's the regulatory burden to actually carry this out would be astronomical. This would be like the nanny state gone berserk. I mean, it would require basically every boat in the world that fishes for anything to have some representative of the National Marine Fisheries Service or some other agency riding shotgun to count the discards, whether it's the lobster fishery or the slime eel fishery or no matter how remote. As practicable adds maybe a little bit of mitigation to it, but I can see where something like this is going to end up. I think we can count discards in a reasonable way without having to go to this extreme, so I'm going to oppose the motion.
Anyone else? Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I share David's idea. I support Sally's intent, but the Groundfish Committee has struggled dealing with ACLs for the recreational fishery and the indirect fisheries over a number of meetings, and particularly with the MRFs data. If we have to develop ACLs and AMs for every component of the fishery, we'll get wrapped around the axle so tight we'll never move ahead. And the when practical bothers me as well, because that's an open-ended comment. I think we'll stumble over that. I think the intent to develop the ACLs and AMs are pretty clear in our goals, and I think would make it a little bit too tight.
Anyone else? Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the intent is good, and incomplete catch accounting and not accounting for all the fishery removals had a devastating effect, in my view, on the ability to manage ground fish. It's causing perturbations in the assessments, underestimating stock size in recent years, I believe. And until this catch accounting, complete catch accounting, is required, we're not going to have appropriate assessments of ground fish stocks, and we're going to be hobbled in terms of management by very low tax and low stock sizes. So that's the reason I support this motion.
Anyone else on the council? You ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. 3. Opposed. 11 abstentions, one abstention. The motion fails, 3, 11, one abstention. Anyone on the council have a motion or another point they'd like to discuss? Dr. Pierce.
Okay, I'll give this a shot. This is the mixed stock exception again. I've already referenced it. And I'll just highlight briefly the key language in the existing National Standard Number 1 guidelines, because it's still relevant today. And that language is, NIMS infers that Congress did not mean to eliminate entirely the longstanding practice of allowing a mixed stock fishery to continue if certain conditions specified in the guidelines were met. And then those are provided. NIMS then says, NIMS believes the guidelines strike the correct balance between preventing a stock from being overfished and achieving OY for the fishery as a whole. And then there are other elements, other parts of these existing guidelines that reference the mixed stock exception and indicate how use of it should be considered when certain conditions are met, if the objective of the council is to achieve the optimum yield for the fishery as a whole. And I think we're all well aware of the fact that we continue to forego a lot of optimum yield from healthy stocks, and that situation needs to be reversed. So I would move that we request the National Marine Fisheries Service to retain the exception to requirements to prevent overfishing in the proposed National Standard Number 1 guidelines, but with the conditions listed in the current guidelines.
I don't think we captured that on the screen. Can we try that again, Dave?
All right. I would move that the council request the National Marine Fisheries Service to retain the exceptions to requirements to prevent overfishing as described in the proposed National Standard Number 1 guidelines, but with the conditions listed in the current guidelines. And I can read those conditions if you would like, Mr. Chairman, so that those who are new to this discussion might appreciate where I'm coming from. Anyways, that's the motion. And if it's seconded, I can provide some additional explanation as to why I'm offering it up.
Okay. Seconded by Captain Avila.
Okay. The previous discussions on this issue, when Chris provided his presentation, make it clear that this sort of strategy is reasonable. Even the SSC has agreed that it is reasonable in order for us not to forego, to lose optimum yield that we otherwise would lose. The staff has indicated that the current conditions, the criteria that one would have to meet in order to get this exception, is they're impossible to meet, and I agree. So why have it if they're impossible to meet? I would therefore like to go back to the current National Standard Number 1 conditions that enable us to consider the mixed stock exception if we do indeed feel it's necessary to exempt one particular species or stock from the mix, that is to allow some degree of overfishing, if indeed that enables us to not forego the yield from other species that would be caught in the mixed fishery. Those conditions that currently exist indicate that the council must demonstrate net benefits to the nation. They have to be long-term rather than short-term. An analysis should be performed to consider technical or operational alternatives to overfishing, and the stock or stock complex cannot be driven to dangerously low levels. That's the existing language. So that existing language can be dealt with. Analyses can be done to see if indeed the mixed stock exception is warranted. If we decide to move it forward in the future, then we'll have the analysis and we'll know whether or not we meet those criteria. But again, without those existing criteria in place, we will never be able to consider the exception, which the service has indicated should be kept in the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, albeit with impossible to meet criteria. So let's have criteria that can be met potentially and continue the mixed stock exception for consideration. We may never use it, but at least it's in there as a tool in the box for us to deal with potential problems such as Gulf of Maine winter flounder, or is it Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic winter flounder? I forget which one it is now. We are going to learn through the GARM presentation that we have to have zero fishing mortality. And I wonder out loud whether that's going to be possible without our dramatically restricting the entire groundfish fishery in the region. The mixed stock exception may enable us to deal with that possible, to deal with that problem of our having to have zero fishing mortality on winter flounder. So again, a tool in the box for us to consider. And that is my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone on the council? Dave Gatham.
Yeah, Dave, just a friendly amendment, would you maybe want to list the section under current guidelines? I think it's just a little bit confusing what section you're reading out of so that people will be able to reference it relative to the motion.
That would be, as the reference would be Federal Register, Volume 63, Number 84. This is May 1, 1998, current guidelines. Page 24221. And page 24231, all of the description, all the rationale is provided in the existing guidelines for the mixed stock exception.
Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? 2. Abstentions? 1. Motion carries 13-2, 1 abstention. Council members, anything further? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of small things on the letter that I don't know if it requires a motion, but I would like to see on the second page of the letter, the third paragraph down, the addition of a sentence that addresses the rights-based management thing, perhaps worded to say in-season adjustments seem incompatible with rights-based management, or it could say incompatible with LAPPs. Either one would work. And the other thing was on the next paragraph down, at the end of it, the sentence further, it is not clear, it should say whether or not or how the inclusion of this information enhances the efficacy or usefulness of our FMP documents. I think we might want to put a sentence in there that says it may, in fact, reduce both. And these are small comments. If it needs a motion, I'll make it that way.
I'm trying to figure out how to handle those 2 points. In other words, do we need a motion to
make it a motion?
Change the language, yeah.
Okay. Then I'll move that we add to the paragraph that begins another important issue that we add a sentence, in-season adjustments seem incompatible with rights-based management. And in addition, the following paragraph, to add the sentence at the end, it may, in fact, reduce both. That's simply to strengthen the message.
there a second? Jim Otto. So for my own purposes of understanding, you're suggesting that LAPPs don't lend themselves to in-season adjustments?
I would think not. If we have sector management plans, then that issue should be addressed in the plan. I don't think that it needs a programmed in-season adjustment. I don't have any problem with in-season adjustments in the input managed portion of the fishery. I think that's a good idea, but it seems that it's incompatible with what we're trying to do with LAPPs. It seems to me that way anyway. So if somebody can convince me otherwise, I just think I think that in-season adjustments that just don't work with LAPPs. As far as the other one is concerned, that's just a technical addition to the paragraph.
Council, any discussion? Sally?
Yeah, I disagree with this motion. I think you could make the same argument for just about any kind of management tool. You could say that if you have an in-season adjustment for under a days at sea system and you exercise it, then the next year people will hedge their bets and fish a lot at the beginning of the year. I think you could say the same under just a strictly quota-based management system where the whole fishery is operating under one umbrella tack, that if the fishery gets shut down early, then one year, then the next year people are going to fish hard the next year. It's not to say that I don't think that you should have the option for in-season adjustment, because if you see a problem, then you should be able to fix it. And I think you should be able to fix it, and you can fix it in under a sector allocation, under an IFQ like we'll have in the inshore sea scallop fishery, in the herring fishery, in the days at sea component of the groundfish fishery. So I'm going to oppose this motion.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I don't even think you're going to get the first year before you start into an Olympic fisheries. People are not going to sit back and take the chance that they're going to be shut down. If you allow for an in-season adjustment in an ITQ plan, in a sector plan, in a open plan, you are going to have people jump out of the gate and make sure they get their fish. You're guaranteeing the problem to happen by having in-season adjustments. Thank you.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having trouble understanding part of this. We've, in our discussion about sectors, we talk about where if one tack is caught, then that may shut down the sector entirely. I see that as an in-season accountability measure, and that's part of sectors. And I even see it from the standpoint of if we had ITQs or IFQs, when somebody reaches their quota, the in-season adjustment means they have to stop fishing. So I'm having trouble saying from a broad standpoint that these aren't measures that could be, that are compatible with LAPs.
Dave Prebble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I don't see the shutdown of a quota as being an in-season adjustment, unless I'm misinterpreting how this works. But that's the question I had and why I wanted to get this out for discussion, because to me, if you've got a sector plan or if you've got a quota plan, then when somebody reaches a quota, they're shut off. That's not really a mid-season adjustment. That was the thing I wanted to get clarified.
Pat Kirkle.
I don't want to get into the middle of the council's comments on the guidelines, but it does seem to me that this is a debate that you should be having when you're developing a management program. The guidelines as they're drafted don't require in-season adjustments or in-season action. They just say to the extent that you can, you should include in-season adjustments. So I think as long as you develop, when you're developing your management program, you provide sufficient justification for why you did or did not include an in-season either action or adjustment, then I don't think the guidelines constrain the council in any way as they're drafted.
Frank Blount.
Yeah, I'm going to oppose it. I'm going back to quite a few years ago on yellowtail when people came to us and asked us to do something because they were discarding tons of yellowtail and there was nothing to prevent it, or haddock when everybody was preventing. If there was a way to do an in-season adjustment and you can protect those, I think it's something that we should leave in there. So I'm going to oppose this. And the fact that we could move that fast mid-season anyway is not usually practical, but...
Anything further? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. 3. Opposed. 12. Abstentions, 1. Motion fails. What did I say? 3-12-1. Motion fails 3-12-1. Chris Kellogg.
There's a second suggestion for an editorial change, and I think, you know, that shouldn't pose a problem that Dave made. It may reduce both, you know. We can add that in if that's it.
Yeah, the whole motion failed.
Okay.
Anything further from the council? Anything further, Chris?
No, that's it.
Okay. Dr. Pierce.
I just wanted to comment to the staff on the detailed work that they put into these comments. This was a very difficult job, and I would wager that no other council has put this amount of thought, staff has put this amount of thought into these comments. Staff, obviously, they're in the trench. They've got to make it work for us. We make the policy calls. They have to figure out how to make it work. So they have done a splendid job looking at these guidelines and trying to help us determine what's feasible and what's not feasible, where the pitfalls are. And they've asked a tremendous number of questions regarding clarifications and warnings, in a sense, to the National Marine Fisheries Service as to where things may go wrong if these National Standard Number 1 guidelines are implemented as proposed. So, again, just hats off to the staff for an excellent job that made our task a lot easier in putting together these comments.
Dave, I understand you're so appreciative that you're going to take the entire staff to lunch. I echo Dave's comments. Extremely thorough. Made it much easier to get through what was a very complex and at times contradictory document. It's now 12 o'clock. I'm going to call for lunch now. Be back at 1:30, and we will start groundfish at 1:30, not 2 o'clock. We're now on the 2 o'clock agenda item, slightly early. I think that's good. We're going to need some time, the extra time. Dr. Paul Rago from the Northeast Fisheries Science.